Summertime for me as a kid was not only we had a pool in our family, and my mom always assigned us a couple rows in the garden to hoe the weeds and playing baseball. But for me, being a bookish little nerd, it was always summer reading season at the library, where I would go stack up on the allotment of 6 Hardy Boy books that I could check out at one time. And so, anybody else fans of the Hardys? Yeah, a few of us. That dates us. younger guys in there, like, what are you talking about? They were old-fashioned when I was reading them. But I often think of like vacations and those kinds of things about what I'm going to read. And if you would have asked me probably 10 or 15 years ago, like, what are your favorite types of literature? Biography would have not been one of them. Biography and autobiography, I just thought were boring, and I didn't see the point. And yet, as I've gotten older, I find myself, I think it is that I'm officially getting old. I love reading biographies and autobiographies, and I was going through my book lists and finding that these are some of the ones that I've read most recently. I know that a lot of you have read the Steve Jobs one, in which we found out that Steve Jobs was not only brilliant, but a huge jerk. And I think I'm being kind from what everybody else has said. And then the second one there is, that's Brennan Manning. I don't know if you all know who Brennan Manning is. He was a priest who left the priesthood because he fell in love with a woman, and he got married, and I think they had a daughter, and then they divorced. And the story of Brennan's life, a lot of it has to do with his alcoholic background and how alcohol really played a big part of his life. And this is the last thing that he wrote. He died about 6 weeks ago, and he knew when he wrote this that this was going to be the last thing that he wrote. And so he writes about his own story and some of his shameful episodes dealing with alcoholism. And then the next one is a chef from, I just started standing like him, a chef from Chicago who had got a cancer of the mouth and had to have part of his tongue cut out. And he talks about what it's like to be a chef, and then specifically what it's like to have one of the finest restaurants in America and not be able to taste all your food. And then the last one, I think, is what we think of when we think of Washington. I think before I read that book, I knew that Washington had wood teeth, cut down a cherry tree, father of our country, wore a white wig. And the book's longer than that. So I learned a lot. What I like about biography, and those of you that are fans of biography or autobiography, is that what you find in almost every one of these people is that you find in biographies and autobiographies, at least I do, that people are much more nuanced and complicated than what you think at first. That even people that do great things in the world, technology or a priest or a chef, whatever, everybody has this, their dark side, right? That there's great things about them. There's things you love and admire and you can learn from. And there's things that you look at and go, oh, I am never, ever going to become like that. And if you love biography, that's probably one of the things you love, that you get inspired. But you also see biography and autobiography sometimes as a warning as well. So what we're going to do here in the next couple months, and the reason why I'm talking about this, is we're basically going to be doing biography from now through the end of this year. And the biography that we're going to do is the life of St. Peter. So for all of this summer, up until we'll take a break and do something else briefly in August, just as kind of a break, but we're going to do the life of St. Peter. We're going to pick out stories from Peter's life and talk about what are some of the major turning points. We're not going to hit every story of Peter, but really the big ones. I think there's about 8 that we're going to get to, and going through like how did Peter's life unfold from being a fisherman to being, in some traditions, either the first pope or at least the first of the apostles. And then after we take a little break in the fall, we're going to look at the teachings of Peter. So Peter wrote 2 letters. At least Peter wrote 2 letters. And many people think that the Gospel of Mark was a disciple of Peter's. And so that many people think the Gospel of Mark is Peter's version of the Gospel, which we won't do much with that except when we're going through the stories. But we're going to spend most of our time in the fall then working through Peter's letters. And so I want to start, as I often do, when I start a series in my office, in my head at least, I start processing, like, what do I know about this? What have I been taught about this already in my life, and where do we need to go from here? And so for just a couple minutes, let's pool our ignorance and figure out how much we know. So open to the floor, tell me everything that we know about Peter. Go. Ariana. He was what? He was a zealot. He wasn't actually a zealot in terms of a political party, but he was a very passionate guy. Yes. Yes. So at times, Peter seems brilliant and has a very strong, vibrant faith. And at other moments, I don't even know him. You know, asterisk, exclamation point, number sign, you know, like that kind of thing. Yeah. What else? First Pope. Good. In one tradition, First Pope. He's the bouncer of heaven. Every joke starts with St. Peter guarding the gate, right? And so he's the one that decides who gets in and who's not, at least in every good joke, right? He cut off Malphius, I think is the name of the guy that he cut off his ear when they came to arrest Jesus. Yep. Walked on water, then didn't. Yeah. Legend has it that Peter was crucified upside down. And I should tell you that the last week of the life of Peter, and this might be, I think it's August 4th, we're going to try to step away from the biblical narrative of Peter and go to the extra-biblical sources. What happened to Peter after the pages of Scripture? And get to what happened in his crucifixion. And we're also going to track then how do the traditions handle Peter? So we're going to talk about the Roman Catholic tradition, where he's the first pope, the Eastern tradition, the Protestant tradition. How have each of those lenses helped us understand Peter? So yeah, the tradition is that he was crucified upside down. Yep. He denied Jesus 3 times. Yes. I've never heard that. Possibly. At least he had a career. Whereas we think John would have been the youngest of the disciples and lived longer than everybody else. Peter is at least into his career. So Peter, Andrew, James, and John together would have been at least on the older spectrum, likely. Yes. Simon, Peter, what's his other name? Anybody? Cephas, or we'll get to that in a little bit. Peter has like 3 or 4 names that get used, and I'll explain it where they all come from in just a minute. We good? Yeah, he's the first to proclaim that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the one in Acts 2, 3. He's the first one to go out and start preaching. Yes. Yeah, hey, he was a fisherman. It was on the slide. Yes. Yes, his brother was also followed Jesus with him. And in the story we look at, we're going to look at Peter's calling at the end this morning for just a minute, and we'll see that too. All right, well, that's pretty good. There's a couple other stories that we'll get to along the way. Before we do, I want to ask this question though. Where has Peter been hiding and why? When I decided to do the series, I went to my bookshelf and I started scanning through my books, right? I have a lot of books that I've collected over the years in seminary and along the way. Usually what happens is when I'm going to do a new series on a book or a topic or whatever, I usually buy 2 or 3 books on that that serve as my sources, primary sources. I didn't have a single book on my shelves about St. Peter. And when I started reflecting on like my upbringing, I've heard many, many sermons about the walk with Jesus on the beach. You know, the one where after he denied Jesus and after Jesus resurrects and do you love me? And Peter says, of course I do. And he says, feed my sheep. I've heard that message preached many, many, many times. And I can't remember many other stories that I've heard about Peter that often. They don't get talked about a lot. Is this true of anybody else? Like many... Just show hands real quick. How many of you think that if you thought about your time, you haven't heard a lot about Peter? He's kind of an invisible, so a handful of us, all right? And so I started asking myself, like, why is this so? Why don't I have a lot of material? Why is there not a lot of stuff in my head that seems to come from Peter? Well, I think there's 4 reasons. One is he's been overshadowed by Paul. In our Protestant tradition particularly, because Protestant theology largely is built on Romans and a lot of Pauline thought, we love Paul, all right? Like, we adore Paul. And so often we talk about Paul, and if you want to talk about books on Paul, oh my gosh, lots of books on Paul. We can find all kinds of stuff about Paul. Not as much about Peter. So Peter often gets eclipsed by Paul, and one of the reasons that happens is that because he was the loser in the Peter versus Paul versus Mary fiasco of Galatians. So, the Mary thing, not really true, all right? So what we're going to find, I think, late in July, I'm going to talk about Acts 15. And if you jump ahead and you want to read about Acts 15, Acts 15 is this episode where in the early church, the biggest issue in the early church is if you're not a Jew and you come into this faith that is primarily Jewish, do you have to follow the Jewish law, all right? And one layer of that is, do we have to eat the same thing as the Jews? A deeper, more profound layer for, you know, especially the men, is do I have to be circumcised as an adult, all right? And so this was vexing, understandably so. And so there was a council, and they got together, and they decided together, hey, here's the deal. And we're going to spend time talking about Acts 15. We're going to talk about Peter's vision. But I want to read to you what Paul says about Peter in this whole context. In Galatians, Paul's talking about Peter. He calls him Cephas. Paul always calls him Cephas. And so it says this: when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. Yeah, Paul's the kind of guy that you want for a friend, right? Like, Paul's the guy, like, I told him off to his face, and what we're going to find here in just a second, publicly, in front of everybody else, I told him how it is. And then, like, with no condemnation, well, yeah, exactly, because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those he belonged to, the circumcision group. You can like them on Facebook. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy, so that by their hypocrisy, Barnabas was led astray. So what was happening is that when Peter was with Paul and the Gentiles, you know, second helpings of bacon, because for Peter late in his life to find out about bacon, I mean, that would blow your mind, right? Like, if you hadn't had bacon your whole life, and then as adults, somebody's like, try this deliciousness. I've been reading this book, Michael Pollan's new book on cooking, and he talks about cracklins. I mean, can you imagine? Late in life, somebody introduced you to the beauty that's cracklins, right? Pig skins cooked until they're crispy. Yeah, some of you are, whatever. No Southerners in the room, or you'd have been whooping and hollering and salivating at this point. So when Peter's with the Gentiles, he eats with the Gentiles. But then when certain Jews show up, the people that had liked the circumcision group on Facebook, then Peter withdraws from them and says, oh, no, I can't do that. And so Paul's saying Peter's condemned in this. What happens historically is we don't hear a lot about Peter. If you read Acts, we hear a lot about Peter early in his life. And then we hear about kind of like this episode. And then we just don't hear about Peter anymore. The story becomes about Paul and what's happening in the Galatian and the Roman and the Ephesian and all the Gentile churches, and the story that started in Jerusalem, it kind of, the locus of the story moves, the focus point moves to somewhere else, and we stop hearing. And so in some sense, the last picture we see of Peter in scriptures is that Peter's the one who stands condemned by Paul. Like, Paul told him off to his face in front of everybody because of his hypocrisy. And so it's kind of a weird ending for Peter in scriptures. And so that might be some of why we don't hear a lot about Peter. In our Protestant tradition, we have an irrational fear of anything that Catholics emphasize. And so the Catholics made him the first pope, and we decided we won't talk about him anymore. Same thing. We do the same thing with Mary, by the way, right? So if you grew up in Catholic churches, you hear lots about Mary, and then you get to Protestant churches and you don't know that there is a woman named Mary. Jesus had a mother of some name, but we're not going to talk about her because the Catholics do, right? And so often I think in Protestant churches, we shy away from Peter because we're afraid that if we start there, we're on that slippery slope to all becoming Catholics. It is an irrational fear. Let's just be clear about this. And in case you didn't know, we sang the Hail Mary this morning as well. So we're well on that slippery slope. 4, because in studying Peter, there's more story and less doctrine. We are all, by nature of just where we sit historically, we're creatures of the Enlightenment, that where reason is king. We've talked before many times about Descartes and cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, that reason is the epicenter. I know what I know because I can reason it in my head. And when reason is king, you don't know what to do with stories. Stories are harder. Stories are a different way of knowing. And so it's more difficult. And so we like Paul because Paul thinks like us a lot. Paul lays out logical arguments for believe this and this and this and this, and we read it in his writings. Peter has left us very little in terms of writings. If you look through your Bible and look at 1 and 2 Peter, it's just a couple pages of writings. In fact, we can get through both letters this fall pretty comfortably. And so what we're left when we study the life of Peter is mostly a collection of stories. And it's harder for our modern minds that like it all broken down into stories. Somebody was telling me, between services, in the month of June, we're doing a class, one of the classes that's running, and we run this at various times, is a sermon discussion class. If you just want to talk about the sermon afterwards, you can go sit and, or for you all, if you want to discuss the sermon before you even hear it, that's great too. That's another dynamic. But somebody, they were telling me about the discussion just this morning after the first service, and somebody was saying, you know what, even in my tradition, when we read the book of Acts, we would go through and pull out the things that were like the statements, the ideas, and we didn't really talk about the story much. And so it's harder for us in our Protestant, in our, not just Protestant, but in our philosophical heritage of modern thought, to get to places where we say, oh, there's something to learn in the stories of Peter. And so we're going to spend a lot of time this summer. The summer is really just stories of Peter, and we're going to try to pull things out and say, how do we orient ourselves to a story? Does that make sense? All right. So that's some of the reasons why Peter's been in hiding. I want to go through this one real quickly because you guys hit a lot of these. So why are we going to spend time with Peter for 6 months? All right. I think I said last week, if you don't like Peter, we'll see you in 2014 because this is where we're going to be for a while. First, Peter was the first witness to the resurrection. After the women, Peter's the first one that sees the resurrected Jesus. This is just a real quick list. He's the spokesperson for the apostles. Anytime we see that the apostles are speaking, it's Peter that speaks on their behalf. Peter's the one throughout scriptures that speaks for them. So they recognize him as a leader in some respect. And in every list of the apostles, Peter's named first. So he comes across, it's pretty clear. And when you read the book of Acts, it's pretty clear that the other apostles follow Peter's lead. He's their leader. He's the first witness to the Gentiles. You kind of mentioned that. He's the first one out preaching right away. After Jesus, he's the most frequently named character in the Gospels in the New Testament. He's out just by sheer volume. There's more about Peter than anybody else. Paul writes more, but more of the story is about Peter. This episode of the sheep descending, Peter's vision of pork descending from heaven, it's just as funny in my head as it sounds, right? So I've seen pictures of this where it's all artistic. It's not at all to me. It's just a big pink pig floating down from the sky that Peter sees. And Acts 15, those two episodes of the early church reorienting itself out of its Hebrew roots into a Gentile narrative, it's hard for us sometimes to get how big this is. And I'll do my best when we get to these events to try to help you understand that what Peter does, the groundwork Peter lays, and what happens in the narrative is that Peter is the one who kind of opens this door, you know, like starts to push it open. Paul's the one who comes and just blows the door away and says, let's go. But it's Peter. It takes Peter to get this thing rolling as far as the relationship of the Gentiles to the church. Yes. So we're going to get to that passage well. The whole that, I know, I'll tell you the date if you want to make sure you're here. All right. So the passage where Jesus talks about on this rock, I'll build this church. Some of that has to do with this and understanding of Peter and all that stuff. Yes. Also important. Seven, this is Jesus has a personal connection to Peter's family. I'm going to tell you this story because I went long last service. So in Mark, if you want to look at this Mark passage, Mark 1, we find out that in the early days of Jesus' ministry, when his ministry is still oriented in northern Palestine, it appears, and there's some good evidence, that Peter's ministry is kind of built out of Jesus' ministry kind of centers around Peter's home. And there's some evidence that Jesus may have been pretty connected. So the story that's in scriptures is this. Jesus has been out teaching, healing, those kinds of things, and he comes home, and Peter's mother-in-law is very, very sick, which tells us a couple things. What? Peter's married, or he's a sadomasochist that has a mother-in-law with no wife, all right? Looking for a mother-in-law. I don't want a wife, just a mother-in-law. He's married. And likely in that era, that culture, you're not married without kids. That's a very brief, you know, like we stretch it out. Jennifer and I were married 5 years before we had children. That's not the way they rolled. So there's a high possibility that Peter also has children. So out of Peter's home, Jesus seems to be doing ministry out of his home. And so when Peter's mother-in-law is sick, Jesus heals her. And so there's a connection that Jesus has at a very personal level to Peter's family. Last one. He is always mentioned in intimate groups around Jesus. So we all have this in our lives where we have, and I think I've talked about this before various times, like we have people that we kind of know by reputation, acquaintances, friends, closer friends, and then we have the people that are like intimates. These are the people that we share everything with. And from what we see in scripture, it appears that when Jesus narrows this list down, so think of Garden of Gethsemane, he asked three disciples to come with him, Peter, James, John, James being his half-brother. So we get that combination. And in every one of those settings, the Transfiguration, Garden of Gethsemane, Peter is part of this very tight inner circle that Jesus, John, the disciple Jesus loved, James, the half-brother, Peter. So very, very, very close to Jesus. All right? Does that make sense? All I'm trying to say is this, all right? Let me just boil it down real simple in case you've just zoned out through all this stuff. Peter's a big deal. All right? If Peter were here today, he'd tell you, he's a big deal. I'm a big deal, all right? I don't know if he'd say that. He probably would because he just blurted it out. But so Peter's a really big deal. We lose him in a lot of traditions. So we're going to spend 6 months on it. Let me just do one last thing before we dig into a text this morning. What's with his name? All right. So it's likely that when he was born, Peter's mother looked at her child and she named him Simon or Simeon. So where does that come from? Anybody want to, where else have you heard that name? Simeon. Not the 12 disciples, but the 12, you're on the right track. No, you're thinking the right thing. The 12 tribes of Israel, one of the sons of Jacob, the brothers of Joseph. So if you're a good Jewish mother and you have a child, it would not have been uncommon for you to name your child after patriarchs, after people that you admired. It appears, historically speaking, that the name Simeon or Simon had fallen out of favor. Not a lot of people name their kid that in Israel. After the 10 tribes disappear in 722 BC to the Assyrians, those names kind of go out of popular usage. But with the Maccabees and the rise of nationalism, and we've talked about that, the rise of Jewish nationalism just prior to Jesus, old names had become popular again. And so the name Simeon likely would have been a political statement by Peter's mother, naming him something that would have gone back to the days when we were whole, when we were a country again. It'd be like if we all lived in the movie Red Dawn, right? And we could all yell Wolverines. I just watched the remake the other night. It's terrible. But I had to. It'd be like that. And so if we lived in, is that what, North Korea took over the United States in that one, in the original, the Russians? What would happen in the next generation is as we all had children, we might start naming our children things like George or Thomas or Patrick. You know, those names that evoke our history and evoke freedom. We'd start naming our Sam Adams. I'd have a little Samuel Adams Dean. And we'd, yeah. So that would be kind of what would happen in that context. And so in their context, to name your kid the name of Simeon, that's a big deal. And so that's probably what is happening in Peter's name here. Bar Yonah, they don't know exactly if his dad's name was Yonah or if his dad's name was John, and that this was a local colloquialism, but we find in scriptures that in that passage you're talking about, Jesus names Peter as Peter Bar Yonah. Now I will call you, and change his name there. So we see that as well. It's just a variation. The bar there means son of. The today's equivalent would be Ben, so Seth, son of Ezra. And then the Greek version of Peter's name, now understand in his time, Rome is a big deal. Peter lives on the north. We find out that he was raised in Bethsaida, which is on the north side of Palestine, close to some major Roman towns and so colonies. And so Petros would have likely been a name that he would have been given as a child, and may have even his friends, this may have been the name he had with his friends. Petros would have been very common for them to use their Greek names. And then in the language that Jesus spoke and the disciples spoke, and in that passage that we keep alluding to and we'll get to in several weeks, he gets called Cephas. And so in Aramaic-speaking churches, he becomes known as Cephas. And I said earlier, every time Paul refers to Peter, Paul calls him Cephas. The gospel writers, written in Greek, tend to go towards the Petros. Paul always refers to him as Cephas. And so as we read the scriptures, I just want you to be aware, Simon Bar-Yonah, Cephas, Petros, they're all the same guy. That's our guy, all right? That's everything I know about his name, all right? Any questions up to this point? So the table is set. We understand? Yes. No, I don't. Oh, that's the English equivalent of Petros. So when Peter gets moved to, I think the journey usually goes Peter, Greek to German to English. As it keeps moving, we take away. It's like what we do with all the Greek words. We take them and we anglicize them. So Peter is the anglicized version of Petros. So where scriptures would say Petros, we get it to Peter. Okay. If you have your Bibles, turn to Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Over the coming weeks, I'll spend time a little bit. It's important to note as we work through the Gospels, and each week we're not going to stick to any one Gospel telling of Peter. The page number's up there, by the way, 835 if you're using a Pew Bible. We aren't going to stick to any one gospel account of Peter. We're going to jump. And so I'll try to make notes as we go and let you know the particular lens. Because each of the gospel writers writes with a particular lens. And so we see different shades of things. And so we'll try to point that out as we do. Luke chapter 5. Now, if you're new with us, I'll tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to read, and then I'm going to invite you to make any comments or reflections on the text as they jump out at you. And so I think in the first service, several people suggested mighty fine, beautiful sermons that could have been done that I didn't do this morning, but you can point at those as we go. Luke chapter 5, verse 1. One day, as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowding around him and listening to the word of God. He saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch. Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. Good catch. All right, so what stands out at you? What's important about this passage? Yeah, so sometimes when we read passages like this, and if you were just to sit down and read Luke for the very first time, you would read it and you would think that Jesus, first of all, heisted a boat. Just walked on the seashore and said, "Hey, there's an empty boat. I'm going to use that." Right? That's the way the story reads if you have no context. So Jesus heisted a boat, and then upon heisting this boat, told these fishermen that he didn't know from anyone how to do their job, and that their response to that was, "Yeah, we're going to follow you forever." Like that, it seems very weird. But if we understand that there's some possibility that they may have known each other for years. There's a possibility that both being from Northern Galilee, they might have known each other already. That there is some interaction that Jesus apparently seems to be at. And Mark 1 may come prior to this. And so Jesus may then be getting into boats of people he knows. He may be telling friends to fish in a different way, but it causes them to see him in a new way, and the call to follow him may look a little bit different than what we think of, where you just like call in tomorrow and say, "I'm done with my job, I'm out of here." It may look differently than that. Yep, good. What else stands out about this passage? Yeah. Yeah, Jesus has a ministry before he calls his disciples. Calling the disciples is not necessarily the first step of his ministry. Things are already happening. And so they're not just responding to the fish. They're responding to, "Oh, we're seeing this," and, "Oh, okay, yeah." James and John, this James is probably different than the James of Jesus' half-brother. And I may have said earlier, I don't know, even in the James John, in the garden account, I'm fuzzy. I said earlier that's Jesus' brother. That might not be the same James. I'm looking at you to help me out. Do you remember? Is that... which James is that? And we're not always sure which James because it just says James. So, but this James that's fishing, we know is John's brother, the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder is their nickname, and brothers with them. So they're all connected to each other. The four of them come together. They all know each other, and it appears that they all know Jesus. So yeah, it's not strangers by any stretch. Yeah, so we get this putting together, and we get that in the Gospels very often, that they put together his Hebrew name and his Greek name so we know who they're talking about. Yep. The Gospel writers do that quite a bit. "I had a good day fishing. I'm a sinner." Yeah. Yeah, let me ask everybody. Why do you think, why this from Peter? Why is this Peter's reaction that he catches a bunch of fish and then he says, "Not worthy, not worthy"? Yeah. Yeah, so to me, Peter, I know this isn't an official category, but Peter is the patron saint of loudmouths, right? Everywhere. So Peter has this habit, and we're going to see this, of just, this is what I think right now. Not like some of you think through what you say before you say it. Some of us, not so much, all right? I'll admit I'm one of these, right? Like, I can't tell you how many times I've left a conversation or a party and think, "I can't believe I said that out loud." Like, again. But Peter is this guy. And so oftentimes we find him just kind of gut level, I feel something right now and it comes out this way. Yeah. Yeah, if that episode happens before this episode, it is not just about fish. Yeah. Yes, yeah. So this is where, like, I was talking to somebody after the first service when we were talking about oftentimes how we teach a passage like this, and this person was saying to me, like, I was in a tradition where people would do this kind of thing, where they would come along and Jesus asked me to do this, and so and they would leave a wake of destruction behind them because they hadn't thought through, like, oh, this means my family goes hungry tonight, or there's things here. And so we read stories like this, and we read them way out of any kind of context. And we have to be careful with chronologies because it's hard for us to go back 2,000 years later and put it exactly in the way. But it seems that this passage is in the context of he knows them. This is not blind. All right, yeah. So if I wander down to OSF and wander into a surgical suite and say to some surgeon, yeah, why don't you do it this different way? I know you're trying to do it this way, but I've got this new thought. I mean, right, you know, like, so why is this guy from shore yelling at us like out of fish? Like, that makes no sense unless, now, this is somebody who, boy, we've seen him do some crazy stuff already. He healed my mother-in-law the other day, and we've seen him do this, and he taught some things, and he says to do it, you know, I'll go out on a limb and do this. Because otherwise, that's just not a logical, we don't do that. If you've been fishing all night and some bozo from the shore yells, hey, you try it on the other side? You know, like, you try putting a bait on that hook? Like, shut up. You know, I know how to fish. But if he knows them, then this is a different thing entirely. Good. Lots of hands. Yeah. At the heart of the story is Peter who responds to Jesus. And what we're going to see next week is it's Peter who jumps out of a perfectly dry boat and says, if Jesus is over there, well, that's what there is where I want to be. Like, there is this thing in Peter that as much as he says whatever comes to his mind, there's also this beautiful part of Peter that just responds to Jesus. Like, almost nobody seems to respond at the gut level that Peter responds to Jesus. And it's really remarkable, which is why, I mean, I just love him. Yeah. That preaches. Anybody else? So let's live on that in a minute. You used terminology just a minute ago. So we talk. Oops. You talked about the befriending, and then you talk about serving, and then you used a word that we use sometimes when we get to this phrase. So they pulled up their boats on shore. They left everything and followed him. You used this word. So what do we think of when you hear this word in most of your context? What does this word mean? I know what it means to me. As a pastor in America, this word has very specific connotations. Yeah. You have a special purpose to do. It has a vocational context. Everybody agree with that? When we hear somebody is called, we put it into a vocational, you have a special thing. So pastors, missionaries, priests, we're the ones who get called. Everybody else doesn't, right? I had somebody come up to me after the first service, though, and I don't know that this is true. I'm just echoing. She does some work in her business. She does some work with, and I can't remember which Catholic group it is, but she said the Catholic group that she works with, at least, doesn't use this language of calling in this way at all. They use it in a much more the priesthood of all believers, which is ironic because that's a Protestant terminology there, but they use it in a priesthood of all believers kind of way, that we're all called to something, that everybody has a calling, whether that's to a profession or it's to full-time ministry or it's to a specific task. Everybody has a calling, that it's something for all of us, not just the spiritual elite or special people. Yeah, go ahead. Good. Did you all hear this in the back? She said that in the Catholic Church that she grew up in, they would end with often Mass in a certain season by singing a song that said basically, we are all called. We're called to serve. We're called to love. We're called to do justice. We're all called. And one of the dangers in the American church, I'll tell you how this plays out for me, is that what happens is I'm in places sometimes and somebody will ask me, so tell me about your calling. And what they're looking for is that specific, you know, my burning bush experience. When did I have that moment where I just knew that I was special? I was set apart. I had a vocational task. And my own story is I feel really inadequate in these moments because I don't know that I had that. I didn't have a burning bush. I had a slow waking up to maybe this is what I'm good at. And I believe right now that I do this thing because this is the place where God has put me, and he's asked me to do these things, and there might come a time where I'm not doing these things, and I'm okay with that. I don't think I'm a special class. I don't see it that way. And I like this idea a whole lot better, that what is happening in this passage. So what's easy to do is when we do it as a special class, it's easy to read a passage like this and then to decide, well, this passage is for pastors and priests and missionaries. This is for people who are in parachurch ministries. This passage is really about the leaving everything, leaving our nets and following Jesus. This is really just for full-time Christian workers. It doesn't have anything to say to me. And yet, I think if we're going to understand the idea of the priesthood of all believers, that all of us are priests, this is the language from Hebrews, then we have to understand that we're all being called, that Jesus is calling every one of us. And it doesn't mean that all of us call in tomorrow and can't quit our jobs, but that we're all being called, and I like the language that you just used, to serve, to love, to work for justice, to do anything we can do wherever Jesus is calling us to follow him. I'm reading this book right now, and it's called Contemplatives in Action, and it's a series of essays by different people who are all writing about what it means to be a contemplative, but also then to be contemplatives who are about the business of doing the work, all right? Because oftentimes we think of contemplatives as, you know, the people that go live in monasteries, and they're trying to say that that's not okay, that we should be engaged, that there should be a healthy, in all of us, a healthy engagement of an inner spiritual life, but then a place where we're involved in the world, where we're all being called to do things. And oftentimes, because we think of calling in this big language, there's this chapter by a guy named Walter Wink, who is an old professor. I think he's in is he Methodist, I believe? I can't remember. But he has a whole bunch of stories, and the chapter, the title is Edifying Tales of Nonviolence, where he talks about people who felt called to very specific ways of standing up for justice, all right? And so I want to share a couple with you because some of them are fun and just talks about maybe different ways and ideas for being called. One of my favorite stories was told to me by the mother of the protagonist. It seems that this kid's school bus was being terrorized by a big kid and the driver did nothing about it. Our hero, it turns out, had chronic sinusitis and his nose ran all the time. So one day he had had enough. Standing up, he blew his right hand full of snot and approached the bully, saying, "I want to shake the hand of a real bully." The bully, his eyes fixed on that hand, slowly backed up until he was at the back of the bus, and that was the end of his career as a bully because the nose was always at the ready. Let's keep this one because we're running late. In Peruvian barrios, where the homes are crowded tightly together and their walls provide little by way of privacy, the women have found a brilliant way to counter the age-long practice of male violence toward wives. When the beating starts, all the neighboring women begin to beating on pots and pans till the husband is shamed into stopping. And the threat of future bangings has a wonderfully restraining effect. In Africa, when a woman has been mistreated by her man, she goes to a woman's club to which she belongs and tells the other women about it. The women go to the village square with their rhythm instruments, and there they play and sing the story of cruelty, and before long, the whole village knows what the husband has done. Isn't that beautiful? People being called into everyday life kind of stuff to make a difference. Occasionally, holy stripping of the kind that Jesus describes in the Sermon on the Mount is literally enacted. Shortly before the end of apartheid in South Africa, bulldozers and police arrived at a squatter's camp and announced to the few women there that they had 5 minutes to clear out their few belongings before the camp would be demolished. The black women, perhaps sensing the prudery of these largely rural Calvinistic Afrikaners, stood in front of the bulldozers and stripped off all their clothing. The police turned and fled. To the best of my knowledge, they never came back. My wife June was leaving the school where she taught when three teenagers came up behind her, thrust a gun in her back, and demanded money. And she simply turned around, put her hand on the gun, and turned it over, saying, "You kids don't mean that. Now get out of here." And surprised by her courage, they ran off. There's one more story that is so absolutely brilliant that it deserves to be featured. I don't know who the author or teller is. As best as I can tell it, there was an old man who lived next to a school, and every day when the school was out, boys would pass by the porch where the old man was sitting and curse him with every epithet they knew. One day, the old geezer called them over and said to them, "Tomorrow when you come by, I'll give you a dollar if you'll cuss me out." That was too good a deal to pass up, so they agreed, and the next day they came back and cussed him royally. "That's fine," he said, paying up. "Now tomorrow I'll give you 50 cents each to cuss me out." "Sure," they said, and they did. And next day, "Now I'll give you a quarter to cuss me out." And they agreed, looking puzzled. "Now," he said, "I'll give you a penny to cuss me out." "No way, that's not worth it," they complained, and refused to cuss him any longer. it's too easy for us to take a passage like Peter leaving everything and dropping his nets and following Jesus. And even if he didn't do it that day, maybe it was a longer process for him in the story and all those things. But it's too easy for us to take a story like this and to make it about pastors and priests and missionaries. To say that there's a special class by God who's been called to do work and the rest of us just do whatever we want with our life. And I think that language of there being a special class needs to go away, that we're all called. That every one of us is called in some way. Maybe you're called to take black bags home, or maybe God's calling you today to go to Honduras or serve breakfast or do something that you just know. You know right now that there's this just this thing that you know you're being called to do something about. And that your response needs to be one like Peter's, where you say, just like, you know, that enthusiasm of Peter that we're going to see over and over again, yeah, I'll do that. And I know it might cost me something, but I'm willing to leave some other things behind to follow Jesus. So what I want to do with our service this morning, just to finish up this last just 2 minutes here, is I want to just leave a moment of silence. Oftentimes what happens is we don't even get quiet long enough. We don't even give enough space to ask, what are you calling me to? What place in this world are you calling me to do something about? How is it that we're supposed to follow Jesus? I told you all the story last week when we were talking about money. I talked about my son Gavin and his desire, I think I said it in the service too, his desire to do something about the people that stand with the signs at the stoplights, and feeling like just to drive by wasn't enough. And so he asked my wife if they could buy, and now they keep in the van, a box of crackers. And so that every time my family stops at a stoplight and there's a person with a sign out there for food, the van door, we have old school, like open them yourself, and they're old, so they make all kinds of sounds, like, and out jumps my 10-year-old with crackers and gives people crackers, because he just, whatever it is in him, he felt called to do something about what he saw. And maybe there's something in you all that you, there's something that you saw this week that you know you're supposed to do something about, and Jesus is calling you, and you're supposed to leave something and follow Jesus. And so I'm just going to give just a brief moment of space, and then I'll pray to close out our service this morning.